The festivities for the 50th anniversary of KBOO are going on. We are hosting a Latinx Peña and open house at Studio One here at 20 Southeast 8th in Portland. We are celebrating 30 plus years of Latinx contributions to KBOO with poetry, music, performance, and food. If you cannot get here to the live event, you can listen starting at 8 p.m. at kboo.fm or on the KBOO app. Our Latinx Peña Open House will be on the air for 4 hours starting at 8 p.m. till midnight. Call us at KBOO Studios for your shout outs at 503-231-8187.
Coming up next on Positively Revolting, Ani speaks with about forest defense as climate defense with Alexander Harris and Brenna Bell, and they take your calls.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Clinton Street Resistance Series at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Monday, December the 3rd at 7 p.m. will be Dune, playing as a benefit for Impact Northwest. Dune is a 1984 American epic science fiction film written and directed by David Lynch and is the controversial adaptation of Frank Herbert's cult science fiction novel. Again, that's Dune, playing Monday, December the 3rd at Clinton Street Theatre, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Cotton Cloud Natural Beds and Furniture, women-owned since 1981, providing sustainable wood furniture, locally handcrafted futons, latex mattresses, and more using organic and natural materials. The Cotton Cloud showroom is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland, online at cottoncloudfutons.com.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought, your
And good morning, good morning. It is 3 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning. You are tuned to KBOO, your community radio station. I'm Ani, and this is Positively Revolting, the talk show every Friday morning that reminds you to, you know, revolt in a positive manner. Today, we are excited to be talking about forest health and climate health. Forest defense is climate defense. That is the name of a new report that was compiled by Oregon Wild, and we'll hear from Alexander Harris of Oregon Wild in just a moment, as well as Brenna Bell from BARC. Brenna is returning to Positively Revolting to talk more about this subject. along with Alexander, and a series of talks coming up. There's still a couple left this fall to get involved with. So we'll get into all that in just one moment. I do also want to remind all KBOO listeners that tonight is a celebration at KBOO. We like celebrating at KBOO. And this is the last open house of our 50th anniversary year of celebrations. So tonight we have an open house here in the studios with live music and refreshments. It starts at 7 o'clock, 7 to 9 o'clock, open house tonight at KBOO, and special programming on the air from 8 to midnight, celebrating the contributions and involvement of the Latinx community with KBOO, making KBOO what we are today. So honoring, thanking, and celebrating Latinx involvement with community radio. And so there's that announcement now gone. I turn our attention to Brenna. Good morning.
Good morning, Ani.
Let's start off with a question about forest. You know, what is meant by forest health? What is a healthy forest? I know it's sort of that could take a half a day.
Yeah, that's a really loaded question. And I think what I would say is if you are hearing someone talk about forest health, look at the messenger. Who is it and what is their interest in investment in forests, right? We came out with George Bush's Forest Health Initiative. Oh, my mic's being changed on me.
Hey. Yep.
Okay. George Bush's Healthy Forest Initiative, for people you remember back that long when government doublespeak seemed
like a new thing.
Right.
Right. And he said that healthy forests were logged forests. And that has taken... and the timber industry uses forest health a lot to push for logging. It seems like their only solution to their, quote, forest health crisis is more logging. And I think, like most things, it's an overdone human term. You know, these forests have been managed by people as long as forests and people have been here. You know, indigenous people and the type of forest we have now kind of arrived at the same time at the end of the last mini ice age, and people have been mostly using fire to manage the forest for basketry, for food, for cultivating their different wild crops for millennia. And that could call that a healthy forest? Some people in the conservation movement are committed to the idea of this myth of wilderness, this no touch, this man as, in the Wilderness Act, it says, a place where man is a visitor and does not stay. And that's its own myth. You know, these forests have been cultivated for a long time, but the goal wasn't commercial extraction and profit. The goal was subsistence and on a scale that helped cultivate the forest that colonizers came to call wilderness. So it's complicated, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I think there is a lot of misuse of the term healthy forest to mean an overly managed forest or a forest that provides commercial product. And what we're talking about, you know, we want to kind of single in on certain values for forest management. And the main one that Alex and I have been working on with several others is forests as a contribution to Oregon's role in fighting and mitigating climate change. So we're looking at how do you create a forest that's healthy both for the wildlife who use it, with lots of big trees and lots of dead trees, because dead trees are great for critters, and also that really is able to sequester and store carbon on a landscape level. And so we're looking at forest health as it relates to human health. Just in very short, commercial logging is the number one carbon emitter in the state.
All right.
And our forests are our number one source of carbon storage and sequestration. So our biggest climate polluter can also be our biggest help in helping resolve or mitigate climate change. So we're looking at forest health as it relates to climate health, and how do we encourage forest management to really build forests that are valued for their contributions to the changing climate.
You're right. That's a really complicated, and it is. And so we see right there at the onset the interconnectivity, right, between having trees who retain carbon, right? Or extracting them, you know, logging them and releasing all of that. And so with that, let's go ahead and welcome Alexander Harris on. Good morning, Alexander.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, for sure. And so you are with Oregon Wild, formerly the Oregon Natural Resource Council. And in October, there is a new report that compiles new scientific findings from many sources. And the title of that report is Forest Defense is Climate Defense. Do you want to give an overview, really, about what the findings are in that report and that interconnectivity?
Sure. So Oregon Wild was founded about a half century ago in Eugene, but it's only been in the last decade that we've been really focusing on forest carbon work and the role that forests play in stabilizing the climate. So about 10 years ago, Oregon Wild released a report called, I forget the name, but it was very long and technical, and it's a great resource, but it wasn't very accessible. And so me and some of my colleagues at Oregon Wild decided to take some of that science and combine it with the recent science that's been coming out on the topic. It's one of these areas in the scientific field that is developing very quickly. We're learning more and more as every year goes on. And earlier this year, there was a groundbreaking report that came out of Oregon State University. And the report essentially confirmed what a lot of other research had already found, which is that logging is actually a major source of emissions. It was known that forests can be a source of sequestration and carbon capture, but the logging emissions side of things was not as clear. So this report brought some more clarity to the issue, gave us some hard numbers with some hard science, and we decided to translate some of that science into an 8-page report. It's very accessible. It starts off going over the science behind forest carbon. It goes into why old growth and our public lands are so important, and then talks about emissions from logging and where those emissions are coming from in the logging process. And then it goes over two policy suggestions, which I can get into in a little bit, and concludes with a pitch to take action. Gives two ways that people can get more involved.
And one way for people to get information pretty readily is a forum coming up in Portland on Tuesday. Do you want to talk about this series of presentations that you've engaged in?
Sure. So this information is very complicated, and that has been probably one of the biggest reasons that this conversation has been slowed down in the last few years. It's not because it's unimportant. This issue is I think, only going to become more and more important as people understand the science, and policymakers feel like they understand the science. So this report was one way that we're reaching people with the science. These forums around the state of Oregon are another way. We started off in Corvallis. Dr. Mark Harmon, a professor at OSU, who actually helped with that OSU report I mentioned, he spoke at that forum. We also spoke at the U of O Law School in Eugene in October. And then last night we were in Oregon City.
That was so fun.
It was great. We had over 100 people from all around Clackamas County, including some rural parts of Clackamas County, which was great to see. And then on Tuesday we'll be in downtown Portland at the First Unitarian Church. Doors open at 5:45 and the event starts at 6:30. And we also have one more forum on the books, and that's in Newport on December 12th. But I should mention, we're also considering doing forums in Bend, Astoria, Medford, and elsewhere.
And so this forum might continue on, as you gain new understanding about where people are really thirsty for this information.
Yeah, at each of these events, we've had huge turnout. It's just been so surprising to see how excited people are about this and how they actually do understand the science, even though it is a little bit more complex and wonky than most issues.
And yet it you know, when you break it down as this report does, I mean, it is very accessible. It is compelling information, and we know the importance of mitigating climate change, right? We know the importance of that. I'm just going to go ahead and assume everyone listening is a thinking, breathing human, and we know the importance of that. And that we in Oregon also know and value the forests that surround us, that define us as a state for so many, especially west of the Cascades, but also, you know, the eastern forests and the amazing biospheres there. So with that, how are people at the end of these talks, how are people feeling? Is it kind of like, are you seeing people glaze over and like, oh my God, it's all too huge? Or are they ready to do something? Are they looking like they want to get active?
Well, last night, I'll just give you an example of what these forums have been like. We had 118 people crowd into a room that was designed, I had intended for 45 to 50 people. And I was expecting 60, and then over 100 showed up. They stuck around for 2.5 hours. They cornered all the panelists.
Yes,
they couldn't get away. Brenna had all these great conversations and connections, and I just think people want more info. Even after 2.5 hours, it's not enough. So we need to do more of these forums.
Absolutely. It was great. There was one moment where we were asking where people came from last night, and there were people from Estacada and from Canby and from Wilsonville and from Gates
and Dundee.
and they were so happy to have something that wasn't Portland, that was more accessible to them, was their community. And first of all, it was really depressing. We're not going to sugarcoat it. Milwaukee Mayor Mark Gamba gave the opening address, and his charge was to discuss how big the climate crisis was, and he did.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so glad I didn't have to follow him, because I was so choked up and scared, as we become when we really let it sink in.
Yeah.
He said, you know, the IPCC report said we have 12 years in which to act to avert full-on climate catastrophe.
Yeah.
Right?
Now that's 11 years because...
Oh,
that's
stop! 12 was short enough. Okay, we have 11 years. And that's it's terrifying.
Yeah,
right?
It really is.
It really is. And it can feel crippling. If we would have stopped the talk after the introduction, that would have been a really hard place to go. And, you know, a lot of us have been doing this work long enough that we don't like to sugarcoat things. We're not going to say forest management is the solution.
Right.
Right? But it is part of it. And it is, so many people were so excited about what the part they can bring. I spoke to a woman afterward who's at Mount Hood Community College in the Natural Resource Management Program. And she and her female colleagues in that program had just started a women's group in natural resource management, and she got really excited about the beavers. Well, if you want, I can talk at length about why beavers are so important for climate change.
Yeah.
But she said, we have a group of women. We know how to use chainsaws and Pulaskis. Like, put us out in the forest. We want to do restoration work.
Mm-hmm.
And then a teacher from Westland High School came up and said that she has students in an environmental club who want to get out in the forest and do on-the-ground restoration work. And I mean, just Pete, and then a man who teaches in the Damascus Charter School, and he wants his students to get involved, and just person after person, I'm like, wow.
Right.
It's and out there. It's so alive.
And so you have these people who want to do this, who have the skills to do this.
Yes.
And it seems to me like if we want to look at an economic model, you know, we could either pay people in rich corporations to further destroy the planet and everything we know and love.
Right.
Or we could come up with a jobs program that would actually restore the forest and restore habitat and restore the planet and help to mitigate the climate change that is happening. Mm-hmm. And I've stopped a few years ago saying we have to stop climate change because we're too late for that.
It's happening.
It's around us. But how can we mitigate it?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. It seems like there's a real clear choice between those two options for me.
I mean, it's not the direction, of course, that the government is going at all. If I may digress a minute, what I was thinking about a lot yesterday night were victory gardens.
Yeah.
I was thinking about victory gardens, maybe because I was thinking about my grandparents, because they grew up in Oregon City in Westland. And they grew up in, you know, they came of age during World War II. My granddad was in the Coast Guard. My grandma was at home growing a victory garden.
Right.
And for the rest of her life, she grew a garden and she put up her food and preserved it. So my mom grew up and she put up her food and preserved it. I grew up doing that. It's like this, and it was a government effort. to support the war.
Right.
Right. So the war wasn't going to be won by Victory Gardens.
Right.
But that change in habit, that change in the way that people engage with their life, was promoted by the government. They're like, we're all in this together. We're all doing this effort together. And your part can be growing this garden.
Yeah.
And it feels like if we had that kind of movement around climate change, there was an overall sense. And, you know, while I have my criticisms of the government, I know that they can move people, right? If there was an actual all-out sense, like this is a crisis like World War II, right? That was a big international crisis. This is also, but it's not that tangible yet.
Right.
And if we were, you know, had the encouragement to take individual actions along with the collective action, like there's a war effort and there's also the Victory Garden.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking, like, it's that level. It has to be on all levels. And we could change behavior as well as changing systems and policy. But it's really hard right now for people to know what to do.
Absolutely.
To know what to grow in their garden, you know? Mm-hmm. And so at BARC, we've been really working on how can we give people tangible things to do that aren't just write their senator. Because it's good, and, you know, Alex will suggest doing that, and that's great. But sometimes that can also feel like, what is my part? How do I get my hands involved? Which is why we're doing beaver restoration now, because beavers are the best thing for climate change.
Okay, well, we'll get into the beaver discussion in a moment, because I'm excited about that, actually. And I want to let people know that you can call in and join this conversation. Call in at 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. This is Positively Revolting. It's talk radio. We're talking about forest defense is climate defense this morning. And with us in studio, we have Brenna Bell. Brenna is a staff attorney and policy coordinator for BARC, and that is the environmental group watching the National Forest of Mount Hood. And we also have Alexander Harris, who is Oregon Wild Public Lands organizer based in Portland. And so please do call in with your questions and your comments. Join in the conversation, 503-231-8187. You can also follow along with Positively Revolting throughout the week in a couple of ways. There is the Twitterverse. You can find us at Positive Revolt. You can also like us on Facebook, and that, of course, we can be found there as Positively Revolting. You can also email us, positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. All right. We do have a caller. Let's go ahead and talk to Dave. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, good morning.
It's turning out to be a nice day. Hi.
Hi.
Are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And so are you.
I'm wondering if anybody is talking about using hemp for paper instead of trees.
That has not, I mean, yes, that has been a part of the discussion for 25 years or more, but that's not necessarily a part of this discussion this morning. We're talking more about the interconnectivity between forests and climate. We're also looking at ways to defend the forest, but not necessarily looking specifically at forest extraction and use.
Well, as a way to defend the forest and stop cutting the trees, we're still going to need to wipe our butts and print out what our stuff that comes on the computer.
For sure, yeah. So to look at alternate fibers for papers is absolutely a piece of this. Absolutely, Dave.
Yeah, that's why I'm wondering if there's anybody, because there is a kind of toilet paper that's made out of sugar cane and bamboo.
Yeah, there's actually quite a lot about alternate paper sources, and I would encourage people to check that out further, and that might be a topic for another show. But thank you very much for your call this morning. That is an important piece of the puzzle. And looking at the use of forests, right? We talk about logging and the extraction industries. I remember 20 years ago, it's more than that now. Oh, look at that. We're old. That we were looking at old growth being cut for virgin paper and for disposable chopsticks and for things that were really just anathema mm-hmm. to any conscious person.
And then we won.
Mm-hmm.
We won for a while.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, there a lot of old growth logging in Oregon slowed down after the really big forest pushes, the movements in the late 90s and the early 2000s. And most old growth logging in national forests stopped. And it's back.
Right.
You know, it really is. I mean, it never became illegal. And I think a lot of people thought that it was. They thought that big old trees were protected.
Right.
You know, Bark focuses on Mount Hood National Forest, so that's what I know best. And I know that in the past 3 years, and I will say three because it hasn't just been Trump, we've been seeing the Forest Service put mature and old growth forests on the chopping block now. There's now a timber sale on the east side of the mountain that's logging forests as old as 250 years old, never been logged before. And where does that go? You know, probably back to paper. Hopefully at least maybe some 2x4s, but it's not protected and it's going the exact opposite way. Like so many policies right now, we know more than ever. And I hope I'm not too cynical, Alex, to say, I don't think it's just understanding the science, but there needs to be the will to act, to change behind it because people know.
Right. We know what's going on.
We know what's going on. And we know now that, you know, it's since the 90s, people started talking about carbon in forests. And now it's very, very clear mm-hmm. that the best place to store carbon isn't even in a wood building. It's in the tree and the soil in the forest.
Right.
And if we're talking about carbon storage, we need to talk about keeping those trees on the landscape.
Absolutely. All right. Well, let's go ahead and talk to Mike. Good morning, Mike. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank
Good morning.
You for your show and the wonderful work you're doing. Couple things. First of all, I don't think logging is just for forest product or for paper products. It's also for animal agriculture. And it's just horrifying how all these complex issues are, they have a common denominator of being global capitalism and colonialism, not to make this issue any bigger, but I was wondering if how organizations are talking to each other across disciplines, you know, if you are talking to animal agriculture or anti-capitalism type of groups as part of this effort as an organization.
Alexander, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think this issue gives us a unique opportunity to transcend some of those divides and have those conversations. For instance, last night at the event in Oregon City, we had 350 Clackamas and 350 Portland and a few other climate, you know, groups and people there. And then we had lots of conservation and forest groups there. And they were all meeting in the middle to talk about that intersection. And we all could identify the common denominator in the problem, which are large industrial timber plantations that are owned by large industrial timber corporations. You know, they're, private lands in Oregon are easily the biggest part of the problem from a climate perspective. And most of those forests are owned by just a small amount of very large corporations that manage it based on the bottom line. And that's what we're all coming together to criticize and also coming together to change. We want to reform the way that we log and the way that we treat these corporations.
Any follow-up there, Mike?
No, that's a nice answer. I would just like to hear if there are any examples of how you, other examples in addition to events of how groups are talking to each other, because I think it's going to be key. And I, quite frankly, I don't think the left knows how to do that very well.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coalition building, I think, is basically a key here. What Mike is talking about is coalition building, and that is something that we struggle with often, but it's also something I've seen wonderful, wonderful examples of as we realize the interlinkages mm-hmm. of the struggle. There's the saying, all struggle is the same struggle. And I absolutely see that when we talk about environmental issues, when we talk about the forests, when we talk about the climate, when we talk about human rights, when we talk about, you know, environmental justice. These things are all super interconnected. Coalition building, how do you have anything to add, Brenna?
I agree, and I like that you brought in the anti-capitalist element of it. Mm-hmm. I think that that's something that actually the environmental conservation movement has not had a strong basis in. Mm-hmm. The climate justice movement has much more comfortability with talking about capitalism as one of the roots of climate change. And I think that that's a place where there's a lot of room for growth in more, you know, kind of traditionally rooted conservation groups like Alex and I work for. We're really having to take on the fact that system change is necessary. You know, BARC started out looking at individual timber sales and trying to make each one better. And mm-hmm. we have succeeded. We've stopped some, we've made them better, but at the same time, the system is keeping churning them out.
Right.
And as we go, we realize that we need to look at the systems that are driving all of this and not just try and, you know, change things at the very end of the road.
Right.
And so I think that that is a really... You know, it's a crucial moment for us, and I think that Alexander is right that this looking at the way forests and climate and the economy intersect is a great growth moment for the environmental movement in Oregon to tackle that.
In, you know, throughout the mid-80s through the 90s up till the WTO in 99, mm-hmm. sort of stopped damn short.
Oh, hey, happy anniversary, WTO anniversary.
Oh, yeah.
It's November 30th.
Oh, my God, Brenna, I'm so glad you're 19th
together. Anniversary.
Okay, back, that was a meaningful moment.
It was.
But, you know, what we have is we used to talk a lot about corporate responsibility, corporate power, and ending corporate dominance in our worlds. And that was very much part and parcel with conservation, with environmentalism, with human rights, with feminism, with, well, basically anything else we wanted to talk about. There is that was one of the key twines in the big knot, mm-hmm. right? And then that discussion was curtailed and pretty much short-stopped after the events of September 11th, 2001. It kind of broke the anti-global action movement that was really gaining a lot of momentum. And, you know, it's been 17 years now. I think it's really time, again, to focus on the fact that the corporate elite actually have business names, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and that the people driving the unsustainable practices have names and really need to be held accountable, both the corporations and the CEOs.
And the government.
The government, for sure.
Because, like, we focus on public lands, and as Alex says, the private lands are part of the biggest kind of problem in terms of emissions, and then the public lands are part of the biggest solution. And I think both contribute to the emissions and the sequestration. On public lands, right now the Forest Service has been told by the powers that be to increase logging 30% across all national forests in the country. Just because. The timber industry are really good Republican donors. Mm-hmm. That's because. But it's the same industry players using the government to, you know, force public lands to produce more. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of them also own the private lands or are owned by the same companies that do that. So there's that intersectionality again with corporate interest. But we kind of have both the private and the public sector engaging in this behavior. And if they could both change it, whew.
Yeah. Yeah.
Plant a victory garden.
I think understanding corporate power is so important with this issue. I have a dream that someday this time will be viewed as the height of corporate power. Mm. And this was the apex when conversations took the next step, when we started naming corporations mm-hmm. and not dancing around this issue. Mm-hmm. We need to own this. Mm-hmm. Weyerhaeuser, Roseburg Forest Products, Willamette Industries, these huge corporations that manage our lands in such a destructive way, they are destroying so many public resources, our water quality, our habitat for the wildlife that live here, mm-hmm. and now we know the climate. And the climate needs to be treated as a public resource. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If it's not stable, if it's not safe, if people are forced, if millions of people are forced to leave their homes and migrate as they mm-hmm. are now, we can no longer afford to just have carbon be a free pollutant. It is one of the most dangerous pollutants ever, mm-hmm. and it needs to be regulated as such. and the corporations who are dumping that carbon in the atmosphere need to be held accountable for that. And that's where this forest carbon work comes in. We need to change our logging practices, especially on private lands, mm-hmm. because the status quo is leading us to a very dangerous place.
Yeah, and if I can just give, you know, a couple, put this in context, 1/3 of all carbon released by humans has been released from deforestation.
Wow.
Right?
Say that again, Brenna.
1/3 of all carbon released by humans has been released by deforestation.
That's huge.
And yet it is not regulated at all.
Right.
And most people are focusing on emissions from fossil fuels, which is very important to focus on. And I don't want to take that away, but we need to increase our discussion mm-hmm. of emissions to to discuss deforestation. And we're not talking about Amazon rainforest. This is our backyard. And not only that, but the temperate rainforests in in our backyard have the potential to sequester and store more carbon than any other ecosystem in the world. So we are taking this incredible asset that we have in, Oregon's part to play in climate mm-hmm. change, and we're turning it into a major polluter.
Right.
A fact to bolster that point you just made. Last year, the Forest Service released a report that found that our national forests, so those public lands that could be a solution to climate change, our national forests in Oregon and Washington are only storing 63% of their maximum carbon storage capacity. So in other words, we have tremendous opportunity for growth. We can have so much more carbon removed from the atmosphere and locked away safely in forests, stored there for centuries, if we do a better job at protecting places like the Mount Hood National Forest mm-hmm. or Willamette National Forest. These are resources that we need to use. They actually benefit us. The whole idea that protecting the forest is doing a favor to wildlife or whatever,
right.
we need to get rid of that. This is a resource. Trees left standing are a resource to us. They help mm-hmm. stabilize the climate.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an opportunity for us right here in Oregon to actually make a significant contribution to the global fight against climate change.
Absolutely. And now, it's how many parts per million? 411?
Yeah, 412.
412 parts per million. So 350.org, right?
Right.
We're way past 350.
Yep.
So we need to focus on ways to get the carbon out of the atmosphere.
Right.
We need to pull it out. The forests are a big sponge that can actually bring the amounts per million down.
Right. Yeah.
And so
again, underscore this point, people. Listen to this.
Alex said it's really complicated. Sometimes I think it's not so complicated. Mm-hmm. Trees are really big sticks of carbon.
Leave there them there go. To continue.
Yeah, and the soil
yes.
also.
Yeah,
the forest
absolutely.
Soil. About 1/3 of the forest carbon is held in the soil. Mm. And that's all disrupted. Yeah. By commercial logging.
And we know that when places are clear cut, the soil is eroded, and we also run into critical situations like landslides that threaten and destroy riparian habitat, and not to mention hillsides where people may have built houses.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen that, and we've seen devastating effects.
And yet they're proposing clear cuts in the Clackamas National Forest, or Clackamas District of Mount Hood National Forest, for the first time in 15 years.
Yeah.
So they're following the private lands example. Mm-hmm. And in private lands, they're decreasing their logging rotation shorter and shorter and shorter, so that carbon is held for less and less and less time.
Well, I want to remind folks you're listening to KABU. This is Positively Revolting. I'm Ani, and my guests this morning are Brenna Bell from BARC and Alexander Harris from Oregon Wild. We're talking, obviously, about defending the forests and mitigating climate change. We have some callers on hold. 503-231-8187 is the number to join them. And let's go ahead and get to, Harvey. Good morning, Harvey. You're on the air.
Hi there. Well, internet companies like Amazon use millions and millions of cardboard boxes for packing, and steep tariffs on soybean exports are hurting farmers in the Midwest. They can switch over to hemp. Hemp doesn't need pesticides, fungicides, or fumicides. Hemp building products. Hemp is fast growing. It's more recyclable than paper. And I think to save our forests, we have to grow more hemp.
All right. Thanks very much, Harvey. Another voice for using alternate sources for paper and seeing the interconnectivity of farming situations as well as resources that are used. So thanks, Harvey, for your call. Good morning, Tim. Good morning, Tim.
Hey,
you're in the
air. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm interested in working at the grassroots level. In the 1990s, I did some work with farmers in Honduras and Costa Rica, and we were specifically focusing on what changes could be made to slow down deforestation and change what changes in their colonization policies could be brought about, right? And the key principles there were making sure people had title to their land and control over their land, but also to give them away. We use permaculture and teaching democratic revolving leadership in cooperatives as a way to turn their land into a permanent base, so that instead of slash and burn for 5 years and then moving on to a new spot, you maybe you slash and burn at the initial attempt, but then that's your family land for generations, right? Because you've got an enclosed permacultural system that produces almost everything the family needs. And with title, they have security. And with democratic organization and membership, they create a political base, power base for change and for preservation of the forest.
Uh-huh.
And then other things you could do is make sure the forest has multiple uses, right? Like you develop a base of mushroom pickers, and they're going to vote to keep the forest alive, so they get access to mushrooms. You get a recreational part.
You're speaking to the importance of recognizing all of the. I hate to use the word value, but value of leaving a forest intact, and how
it in fact
feeds.
People see that and see the value, and you've developed the constituency to organize to support that. Then you're going to create pressure to keep the forest healthy.
All right. Thanks very much for that, Tim. And Alexander, you want to go ahead and speak to that?
Yeah. I wanted to mention something that is kind of an evolving conversation in the conservation field, which is the idea that if we were to value the carbon storage that these forests are providing, then there would be an economic reason to not log these forests so aggressively. So for instance, on private lands, when we talk about industrial forestry, we're talking about whenever you've seen a clear cut, whenever you've seen a monocropped, thin, densely packed trees, those trees are cut every 35 to 45 years, very short rotation. And the amount of carbon stored is just a fraction compared to a native, old growth, or intact forest elsewhere. And the idea is not necessarily to convert all these plantations into old growth, even though from a climate perspective, that would be the best thing that we could do. But instead, to lengthen the rotation for these forests. And a lot of timber companies don't want to do that. They don't want to wait 60 years before harvesting a chunk of their land because their investors want a return right now and they need to report to their investors. And so we need to somehow give an economic value to those landowners who are doing the right thing by waiting 60, sometimes 80 years before harvesting. Because I wish I could show a graph by the radio, but I can't. The science is very clear. The longer you wait, the better, the more optimal your carbon storage. And 60, I've seen other research that says 80 years is the optimal time to harvest. If you are going to harvest the trees, that's the best time to do it for carbon storage. After that, it starts to level off. But that itself is a value that is currently not recognized economically. And I think we need to work hard to find those policy solutions that give value to forests for other purposes, not just timber.
And also in terms of policy solutions, Alex, do you want to talk a little bit about what y'all are doing to change the Oregon Forest Practices Act? Because until that law changes and makes some of the practices that are currently legal, kind of brings them up into the modern era, so to speak, I don't think we're going to see things change, even with economic incentive.
Sure. So Oregon Wild is beginning to do more and more work on reforming our logging laws. The state of Oregon regulates how we log on private lands. If you've ever seen a clear-cut, a monocrop plantation, it's likely that that is owned by a timber corporation, and that kind of operation is perfectly legal under the current framework. Mm-hmm. The framework was passed in the 70s, and it was a big deal for the time because back then there were hardly any rules on the books. You could do all sorts of things. But since all the neighboring states to Oregon, such as Washington, California, Idaho, they have passed more stringent laws that say, yes, you can log industrially, but you can't do whatever you want. There are certain rules. You have to leave certain stream buffers. You have to leave a certain amount of trees on the landscape. So what we're trying to do right here in Oregon is start to build up the grassroots movement to reform Oregon's logging practices. And the law that we need to focus on is called the OFPA, Oregon Forest Practices Act. If we are able to reform that law with better logging practices, then we will have, of course, tons of water benefits, tons of benefits to local communities, but also carbon storage benefits. Mm-hmm. I'll just highlight maybe two or three things that we could do to reform that law.
Please.
Let forests grow longer before you harvest them again. So extend that rotation. Instead of every 40 years, extend it to 50, 60 years, maybe even longer. Leave more dead and live trees on the landscape after an operation. So in other words, limit the amount of clear cutting that you do. Clear cutting is the most destructive forestry practice, and it needs to be something from the 20th century that is dead.
Right.
We need to move on to a modern form of forestry. And the last thing I'll mention is encourage biodiversity. The idea that we can treat our vast forests that are surrounding our communities as plantations of Doug fir and nothing else, that are sprayed by helicopter several times in the first 5 years of after being planted, those sprays kill everything other than Doug fir.
Mm-hmm.
And the spray, of course, runs into streams, yeah, affects local communities and wildlife, but also is devastating to all other life forms that depend on those landscapes, except for Doug firs. And so we need to understand a forest as an ecosystem, not just as a means to an end, not just as a means to board feet.
Right. I want to let people know that you are listening to KABU. And coming up at 9 o'clock, we have Making Contact. That's a show that's exploring the expansion of gender identity and Trump's threats to transgender, intersex, and non-binary Americans. At 10 o'clock, Valley Views lists 11 aggravating actions, statements, and beliefs commonly directed toward Black people from white progressives. At 10:15, it'll be Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, Mr. Jones's Neighborhood is the children's show for reluctant adults. All this and so much more coming your way on KABU. We have live music coming up on Song Circle between 1:30 and 3 this afternoon. The Latinx Open House with special programming on air from 8 to midnight, and an open house here at the studio 7 to 9 this evening. So much going on. It's your community radio station. Please do support it. If you have not become a KABU member yet, you can do that by going to kboo.fm and click donate. We have so much to talk about. We have 10 minutes left. Let's go ahead and talk to Francesca, actually. Good morning, Francesca. I understand you were at the talk last night.
Yes, thank you. I just have 2 points I'd like to make. This is a great show, and thank you so much for having these wonderful people on. I learned so much. But my first point is that I wish we could take every Oregonian and walk them through an old growth forest and then take them to a state lot and walk them through that, because it's really, really sad. I have walked through lots you can pull off of Highway 26. A lot of that land up there is state, and you can walk up through the gate. The soil is sour. There are no birds. There's no mycelium. Mm-hmm. It is really horrible. It's like the Holocaust. And most Oregonians have no idea how really awful it is. So I wish we could have some more exposure to that. And my second thing is that you mentioned several state legislators that were doing good things and not doing good things, and even county commissioners, and things that people could do, contact, write letters, those kinds of things. If you could, before you have these kind of meetings, if you could just do a half sheet to remind us of who these people are and what we can do that can be handed out, I think that would be really helpful. I did make notes as soon as I got home, and I will write letters, but I think that having some really concrete things that people can do right away after these meetings would be a great gift for them. And that's all I have to say.
Thanks very much, Francesca, for your call this morning.
Could I just respond really quickly?
Please.
So that's a great suggestion about the takeaway. We're actually planning on doing that for Portland, having a quarter sheet that identifies the action items, something I wish we would have done for last night. But Francesca, just to highlight one of the best things you can do to reform those practices on state land and private land, those clear-cutting practices, call Governor Kate Brown and call your state legislators. Everybody is represented by one state representative in the state house and one state senator, and they represent you. They don't know what to do unless they hear from you. Otherwise, they're going to do their own thing. So call them, and it's very easy to look their number up. Call them and say, I do not support clear cutting as we currently do it. I think we can do a better job from a climate perspective, from a water perspective. Please reform Oregon's logging laws. And if you make that call once every 2 weeks, you are already helping move us forward towards actually reforming this law.
And I want to appreciate your first comment. I think it's true that there are a lot of people who don't know what a forest, quote unquote, should look like. And I include new forests too. Like recently burned forests are an amazing thing. Old growth forests are an amazing thing. Forests where natural processes prevail are amazing. And there's not much access to them for a lot of people. So I will plug Bark's monthly hike, because I do think when people get out into the landscape and create more of a personal connection with it, beyond even what we're talking about, I mean, climate change still feels a little abstract, but when you come to a place and you see it and you learn that it might be threatened, that does bring a desire to act and appreciate what we have. So if you are interested in getting out to the forest, but maybe you don't have a car or you're not sure where to go, Bark does a monthly hike every second Sunday of the month. We've been doing it for 20 years. And we'd love to have you come out. You can check our website. It's bark-out.org. And it talks about our monthly hike. And then we do an in-town ecology club to talk about the different systems in the forest. You know, it's been very diverse, everything from Bigfoot to bats. And there is, a Bigfoot expert, Mount Hood National Forest. And we love to talk to people about the forest and the processes that are going on and how you can get more involved. I mean, there are so many ways, both hands-on and writing and calling in advocacy, and we like to help people with the tools for
that. Can you give us a 2-minute synopsis of why the beaver is so important?
Oh, beavers. Yes, I can. All right. So beavers are a keystone species, meaning they have a disproportionate impact to their environment relative to their abundance. And beavers used to be way more common in North America. There were once 400 million beavers in North America, which meant there was a lot more water on our landscape. And those beaver ponds provided habitat for countless other mammals, insects, fish, and birds. And then they were extirpated by the fur trade. It was one of the first major blows of corporate-driven economic exploitation. Now there's only 15 million beavers in North America, but they're making a comeback. And one of the reasons they're so important as a climate change mitigator is one of the major impacts we're going to see is on our water systems, right? So the glaciers in Mount Hood are already melting. They're about half the size that they were in pre-industrial times. And a lot of our winter snow is falling as rain. So the snowpack that provides our summer water and the glaciers that provide our summer water are melting, and they're just flashing down the systems. And all that water is leaving the watersheds. But when a beaver comes in and builds a dam, that water stays. And so when there's a flood, rather than just scouring out the creek, it stops behind a beaver dam and pools and turns a meadow into a wetland. And then that elevates the water table. So in the summer, when the drought comes and there's not enough melting glaciers, there is water from the water table to recharge the stream systems. That was fast. But take it from me. The more I learn about beavers, I've been doing forest work for 20 years, and the more I learn about beavers, I'm like, why haven't I just been restoring beavers? Because getting them back in the ecosystem provides so much benefit for biodiversity and climate resiliency that it's kind of amazing that we have these natural allies out there that we have not done well by.
Yeah.
And so BARC is focusing and working with Mount Hood for a change, with the National Forest Service, on restoring beaver habitat throughout Mount Hood. And it is so enlivening to have something proactive to do rather than just stopping bad projects, which we're also doing.
That's fantastic. Actually, I'm super glad we got that in there. We have just a couple minutes left. I want to try to get Dave on. David, you have a quick question or comment?
Yes, thank you. First of all, I'm just grateful for everything that's been said. And dovetailing with the proactivity, I've heard a lot of you speaking about limiting deforestation and managing cutting down trees, which is, of course, so important. My question is about, what about a massive national or global tree planting, forest planting, maybe a victory forest? In other words,
reforestation.
I'm thinking about
efforts.
The Greek
afforestation,
but on a massive scale, both urban, suburban, and in national lands. I'm thinking about the Green Belt movement in East Africa. Mm-hmm. But what would impact if proactive, if there was a massive global tree planting?
All right, David, thank you very
project.
Much. We're almost out of time, so let's answer that.
I would say it would be fantastic. Mayor Mark Gamba in Milwaukee yesterday said that part of their climate action plan is to increase the tree canopy in Milwaukee from 20% to 40%. If every municipality could make similar goals and start planting, and we could reclaim logged over or abandoned agricultural land for forests, that all would make a huge difference.
And so next Tuesday night, December 4th, there is a forum in Portland. The details of that again for people that are able to go.
It will be at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. The doors open at 5:45. We have beer and cider and wine donated by local businesses. There will be free pizza and snacks and organizations with tables set up. That will be from 5:45 to 6:30. 6:30 is when the program begins. And we'll hear from expert panelists on this issue, on forest carbon.
All right. I want to thank both of you for being here. How do people contact your organizations for more information or to get involved?
Well, on this point, I wanted to make a plug for the climate report. You can find it at oregonwild.org/climatereport. Very easy to find, and it's very easy to read, so check it out.
Mm-hmm. And with BARC, our website again is bark-out.org. Or you could give us a call at 331-0374 or swing by our office. It's actually right by KABU. We're on 18th, just off of Sandy, and we love visitors.
All right. Thank you both for joining us, Alexander Harris and Brenna Bell. Thanks for your good work.
Thank you.
Lou, Community Radio is hiring a development director. This 32-hour-a-week position develops and implements the yearly fundraising plan, develops promotional and press materials, and supports the anti-oppression work of KBOO. Send a cover letter and resume to Delphine Crescenzo at del@kboo.org or send to KBOO, Development Hire, 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Please answer in the cover letter the question, why is KBOO important? More information on the development director position is available at kboo.fm/developmenthire2018.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Top Dog Underdog, running Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays through December 1st at the Chapel Theater in Milwaukee. Top Dog Underdog tells the story of sibling rivalry between African-American brothers and a turbulent relationship punctuated with dark humor. Their names are Lincoln and Booth. The show has adult content and is not recommended for children. Again, that's Top Dog Underdog, running Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays through December 1st at the Chapel Theater, 4107 Southeast Harrison Street in Milwaukee. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm. Coming up this morning on KBOO, Next, Making Contact explores the expansion of gender identity and Trump's threats to transgender, intersex, and non-binary Americans. At 10, Valley Views lists 11 aggravating actions, statements, and beliefs commonly directed toward Black people from white progressives. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And 11, Mr. Jones' Neighborhood is the children's show for reluctant adults. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by your support.